I'm Chuck Smeaton from the Royal Institution of Australia, and this is the Cosmos Briefing Podcast. Today, we talk to Dr. Chadden Hunter, an Australian wildlife biologist and filmmaker. After completing a PhD on Gelida baboons in Ethiopia, Chadden worked with National Geographic and Discovery Channel, filming everything from tribal ceremonies in Africa to snow leopards in Pakistan. On the BBC series Planet Earth, he became known as the guy covered in bat poop, and whilst filming Arctic wolves for Frozen Planet, learnt that minus 40 degrees Celsius was cold enough to freeze your eyes shut. His credits include producer-director on Planet Earth 2 and Seven Worlds, One Planet, co-series producer of BBC's Wild Arabia and National Geographic's Cliffhangers, and principal director of the Frozen Planet series. Collectively, the series he has worked on have won 12 Emmys and 8 BAFTAs. He's also the winner of Best Film Documentary this year in our own Cinema International Science Film Festival. Today's interview is hosted by Cosmos journalist Dr. Deborah Devis.
Hi, Chadden. It's really lovely to have you on our show with us. You've had an incredible career. It's very diverse, and it's come from this very science aspect to moving into arts and that combination between arts and science. So tell me how you transitioned from your PhD into film and how your science background has now shaped your career.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah. I was always passionate about nature and loved sharing my love of green things and fluffy things with as many people as I could. And I imagined myself as a biology teacher. I thought that was the best way for me to get other people excited about bugs or the jungle or whatever it was I was interested in. And so I went through science and maths in school and ended up doing a PhD in biology. I was lucky enough to be studying monkeys in the mountains of Ethiopia. But I began to realize that in all of that maths and science, there was something missing about being able to share that information with a wider audience. Now, while I was up there doing my PhD studies, a film crew came to my field site and made a little film about myself and my research and my monkeys. And then the next year, National Geographic came and did a magazine article about my work. And I realized that each time I worked with those media bodies, I was getting word out to 40 million people, whereas about 4 people in the world ever read my PhD, or maybe about 3.5, because I don't think my dad ever finished it. But for me, that was a real epiphany about the power of medium, and especially television as a medium, to reach more people. So I was always driven about my passion to share my love of nature with other people, and here all of a sudden landing in my lap was this incredible tool that went far beyond my academic papers. So that's what started me on this drift from academia into filmmaking.
And that's really interesting as well, because I suppose a lot of people can kind of think that the only way you can make a difference is in research, but clearly the impact is really different. But why is it so important to have all of these people have access to science? Why is film such an important medium in that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a great question. And I think a lot of us who love science and get deeply involved with it kind of assume that everyone else will love it and that it will just speak for itself. And I think we forget that the vast majority of people learn things visually and through storytelling type experiences. And finding ways to reach people and get science in front of people means we have to go to them and to basically look at how people are ingesting information. And in this modern day, people ingest information through a screen more than ever before, whether it's a smartphone or a tablet or TV. And it used to be that only experts could really get information out there because you had to be peer-reviewed and published. Journalism and newspapers were a bit slower and steadier. But in an era of digital communications and social media, when almost anyone can say anything and anyone can spread that information, the battle over truth is greater than ever. And so I think it's more important than ever that science goes to that battleground, which is really on people's screens and in people's popular cultural feeds. That's where we have to get the word out about science and basically get people believing in a more empirical way to understand the world, as opposed to knee-jerk reactions or fanciful memes.
I mean, I still like the memes, but you're absolutely right. And it's really hard to kind of battle this onslaught of disinformation and misinformation and just not really knowing where to go to look for this kind of information. Reading papers is hard and reading papers is quite boring. And so you've created this enjoyable way for people to learn and understand science. But why does that even matter? Why do people need to see science? Why do people need to learn about it?
Well, I think science is it's a little bit misunderstood by a lot of people. And it really is such a simple way of understanding the world. It really is when I'm talking to kids about it. It's about trial and error. It's about the way that us as a species have always tried to explore the world around us from the first moments that we were trying to work out what materials would make a fire best, or work out what plants in the forest might make us feel better if our kids were sick or something. We've always been a species that has wanted to understand the natural world by trial and error. And the wonderful thing about science is it just moves from corrected truth to corrected truth. It makes mistakes, but it doesn't have an agenda. There's no politics to it. It's not trying to brainwash people or move people in a different direction. It really is just the heart of how humans try and understand the world empirically. When I watch my toddler and I kind of scream at him to stop breaking things, I realize that actually what he's doing is just testing things. He's just testing to see what breaks, to see what materials do. And that's very much human nature. So I think returning to that empirical, quest is what I would hope we can convince more people to do. Don't just listen to someone tell you something on a TV channel. You know, go out and explore the world and learn it in a way that you can understand. You can kind of slowly do things by trial and error. So it's about questioning and keeping curiosity. You know, it's curiosity that has made humans as a species so successful. And so, you know, I think it's an inbuilt thing that we just need to kind of reconnect with.
And that's incredible as well, because that curiosity bleeds over into art, that, you know, it's an expression of human nature and it's an expression of human thought. And you want to have that curiosity in art, and you want to have the curiosity in science. And so they actually meld together quite well. Yeah. So how do you use your scientific curiosity and your artistic curiosity while you're filming?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. I mean, I still love the science, and I love learning about the natural world, and I still find animals fascinating and the things that animals do fascinating. But trying to work out a slightly simplified version of that story to share with people is the challenge of filmmaking. It's about making information digestible, and that's what a good journalist is good at. Now, we have with filmmaking some incredible tools for manipulating the senses, as opposed to reading a scientific report, which, as you say, Deborah, is sometimes hard to keep awake through because you've got to concentrate on reading a scientific paper. But what we have with film is the ability to fill up the visual senses of a human, to fill up the soundscape, to even add music, to add an emotional level, to add words, to add information, and then to wrap it all up in a story. And humans as a species, we love digesting things with a story. We love a narrative. And politicians have learnt this over the years, that it's not just about giving people facts and figures. You give them a good story. And humans, we sit around the campfire and we love to listen to a good story. And so what I find in filmmaking is there's this incredible multi-sensory package that you can wrap someone up in. You can put them in front of a screen for a minute and get them to absorb something more, a scientific story or science through a story, than we could if it was just on a paper. I think any of us who've been even in high school or university classrooms will know how dry a lecture can be. And then as soon as the teacher puts on a video to show you something, how many people will sit up and enjoy that little bit of class? And I think historically we haven't taught science by using a multimedia approach as much as we do these days. And I think what we're now accepting is that storytelling and visuals and a multi-sensory approach is an amazing way to get information into the mind of a human. So it's really exciting to be able to share science through filmmaking.
And as well with that storytelling, not only is it amazing for getting people to understand a concept, but it shows the concept in context instead of just random facts that seem to be going, you know, unrelated to anything. But if you're filming wildlife and searching for that, do you go in knowing what the story is, or do you have to search for it and come up with a story later?
It's a bit of both. It's a very interesting question. We do a lot of research for a big wildlife documentary, a big David Attenborough show. We might do 6 to 9 months of research where all we're doing is talking to scientists. We're on the phone asking them about what they see the animals doing, how often they see them doing it. If we brought a camera, what are our chances of seeing that behavior again? How long would we need to stay to see the animals doing it? So we do an incredible amount of homework before we actually go out to try and film these things. And we also try to storyboard it. We try to imagine what the shots would be and what the information would be and how we can impart that visually. I had a researcher recently get really excited about this incredible story about wolves. And I said, wow, what is it? And I said, well, these wolves have this ability to delay ovulation. And it means this and this and this. And I thought, that's a wonderful story for a magazine, but how on earth do we visualize that? So we're always being very careful about how can we visualize these big glossy wildlife shows. And to be fair, the big glossy ones, they very much are, they have to be visually driven, but it takes a lot of your, you know, your science brain to digest the information, and then that slight journalistic hunger to try and find a way that, God, how would I explain this to my mate in the pub, or how would I explain this to granny? So yeah, it's a real challenge, but you know, that's you know, a wonderful part of the job.
And that is a unique skill as well, not only digesting that information, but then explaining it in a way that's not too complex for your mate in the pub to understand. That's not always an easy thing to do. But I think that the fact that you have to go through close to 9 months or more research of talking to people, that means the end product that we're getting, the end story, even if it sounds like it's only coming through one voice, it just sounds like David Attenborough is narrating the whole thing. It's the voice of hundreds of scientists.
It really is. It really is. Yeah. And even right to the end, you know, working with David Attenborough is amazing. He still is very, very sharp, and he's an incredible naturalist. And even though I write the script for him, he will scrutinize every line and make sure that even if we veer off into popular language or the vernacular, it's not drifting away from what the truth is about that animal. And often, even after we get to the stage where we've edited the pictures and we've got the music and we've got the drama of the story, even at that late stage, maybe 2 years down the line, we all go back to the scientists and show them the rough edit and say, okay, are we getting this right? You know, it doesn't actually have to have the, sometimes the scientific terms in there, but we do not want to mislead the audience about what the truth actually is.
And that is an incredibly long time. So if you're looking at something like Seven Worlds, One Planet, your South America episode, how long did that take to film?
Well, we worked on that for about 3 years. So we do about 6 months of research before we even allow ourselves out the door, because we want to make sure we're getting our stories right. And then we film for about 2 years on and off in various continents or various parts of the continent. And then we edit for about another 6 to 9 months, where we're just pulling all the images together, fine tuning our script, working with the music and giving it that final polish. And then with David at the end. So yeah, it's an immensely long time. But then we're going out to try and capture footage that has never been seen before. And if you're going to have that kind of bar, then the time and resources needed are immense naturally. So yeah, it's a real marathon to make 1 hour of TV at the end of it.
And worth it, because when it's coming out as factual and, as you said, film that nobody's ever seen before, that's a massively incredible feat. So when you were in South America, did you find that there were certain challenges associated with filming there that were different to difficulties that you had in other continents?
Well, one of the challenges with trying to make a film about South America and what unifies the wildlife there is it's such an incredibly diverse continent. It covers about 12% of the planet, and yet it's home to more than 40% of all species on Earth. And it has scorching deserts. The Atacama Desert is the driest in the world outside of Antarctica. But the Amazon, it's got the Andes with incredibly high peaks. This incredible range of habitats. So to try and find themes that really told you something about South America as a package was quite a challenge. In Seven Worlds, when we did the Australia episode, it's a little bit more homogenized as a kind of a dry continent. When we did Antarctica, that's quite easy because you get that it's frozen and icy. But yeah, I think the biggest challenge for South America was how we kind of found a way to explain the deserts and the glaciers and the rainforests and show you that there was a, that was something unified in that continent that made those animals the way they are.
So was the story when you were looking, did you think about that unification of such diversity and you sought that out? Or was that something that accidentally fell on your lap?
Well, the diversity of South America, it was like a blessing and a curse. It was the one episode in the series, the one continent where it was almost hard to know what to leave out. We wanted to give a sense of the color and the richness. And so we've got our beautiful macaws in there. And we wanted to have a range of taxonomy. So we wanted to have big things like the wonderful puma hunting in Patagonia. We've got penguins on the coast, even down to tiny poison dart frogs in the Amazon doing amazing things by carrying their tadpoles around. But yeah, it's a real jigsaw puzzle to try and get the right cast of characters that make it feel balanced across the taxonomy, across the habitats, and then across the themes. It's when you watch these big Attenborough shows, you'll notice that there's some scenes that are dramatic. There might be predation, which is a bit upsetting. There's some scenes that might be a little bit more comedic, like courtship amongst birds, or there might be some that are a bit more heartwarming, like parental stories. And so for us, we're taking you, the viewer, on a very emotional roller coaster ride. That's the idea. We're trying to hook you in and take you on a really emotional, gut-wrenching ride. But we've got to make sure there's a balanced journey so you get to the end. It's like getting to the end of a chocolate box and feeling like it's been a very satisfying experience.
So,
and it usually is with a chocolate box.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. That satisfaction is something that you've taken 3 years of being in this incredibly vibrant place, talking to these people who know about all sorts of animals that, you know, a lot of us have never heard of, and then putting it down, condensing it down into this kind of 1 hour feature. Over that whole time that you were in South America and getting ready for it, was there one particular moment that stood out to you as incredible, regardless of whether it made it onto film or not?
I mean, in terms of just the sheer experience of it, when we were filming around Angel Falls, the world's tallest waterfall up in Venezuela, it was incredibly hard to get access to. And we had to go and camp there for a few weeks to film those waterfalls. We had to use a helicopter, and it was very, very dangerous flying conditions because we wanted it to be at the end of the wet season when the waterfall still had a lot of water pouring off. But it meant that clouds could form really quickly, and a helicopter can't fly through clouds. It has a visual of where to land. But we're flying along one day, and the captain started yelling in Spanish about the cave. And my Spanish isn't that great. And I was like, what's he talking about? And I realized he was flying us into this gigantic cave. It was like something out of science fiction. And as a helicopter, we just flew into this cave, and he said needed to wash the helicopter. And I was like, oh, this is not going to end well. And we basically flew into this cave in which a waterfall was pouring in, and then landed the helicopter at the bottom of a waterfall and got out casually and just started kind of rubbing his helicopter down in this waterfall. And we were just like shaking, like, I can't believe you could do that with a helicopter.
That's incredible. I think it sounds like you need a very strong sense of adventure to be able to do this. So what advice would you have for young people to engage in science and film or to pursue this in the future? And how has that science background informed all of that future filmmaking?
Yeah, I mean, science for me has been a wonderful journey. As I said, for anybody who's got a curiosity about the world and wants to learn how it works, it's a wonderful career. You know, you'll always find fascinating things to learn in it. And it leads to so many other careers. I mean, as I said, I started off science thinking I'd be a science teacher. I've ended up in filmmaking, and I think it helps me a lot because I have a... that I've kept that questioning instinct. And, you know, something about the scientific process is not taking things at face level, is to ask that deeper question, maybe ask for a second source of information to kind of keep that curiosity up and to just kind of dig a little deeper. And I think those skills are invaluable no matter what we end up doing. The kind of the analytical mind is a really, really fun experience. And I think, you know, you can take that science learning and that analytical adventure, you know, that kind of investigative spirit into so many other careers. So yeah, I think science is a glorious career.
And it's such a key point as well, because it's easy to think of science as just a bunch of fun facts or not fun facts in some people's opinions, but it's not. It's about that analytical thought. It's about that curiosity, and that can take you into a helicopter that almost flies through a waterfall, like scary stuff. So thank you so much for talking to me today, Chetan. That was absolutely fascinating, and good luck with all your future endeavors.
Lovely. Thanks, Deborah. Lovely chatting to you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. Remember that you can head to cosmosmagazine.com via the link in the description for more great content. You can also subscribe to Cosmos Magazine, Australia's only science print magazine, and Cosmos Weekly, our online subscription-based deep dive into the biggest issues. You can also watch and listen to all our Cosmos briefings via the link that you'll find in the description. And given the subject today, you'll also want to register to watch all the films in the Cinema International Science Film Festival this year. It's free to do so, and the link is again in the description. And remember, if you support science and its communication, please support our work at the Royal Institution of Australia. I'm Chuck Smeaton. Today's interview was hosted by Dr. Deborah Devis, and our executive producer is Catherine Roberts. Thank you.